You are listening to Cut Jib Newsletter Speaks, the podcast, episode 24 we are on for Thursday, May 19th, 2022. JJ Sefton is here with CBD and once again returning our co-blogger and friend, Buck Throckmorton. Gentlemen, good afternoon. How is everybody doing?
Doing good great. Afternoon. Good to be here.
We're lucky to have Buck here today because Sefton and I were jabbering fools yesterday on our podcast, and Buck is here to inject a note of maturity and structure to our day. And to that end, he's given us a bunch of great, great topics to discuss. So hopefully it will flow a little bit better than the rap session that Sefton and I had yesterday.
Yes, he brings a Southern gentility and charm to the two Jews with three opinions, and which is the alternate title of our podcast. Anyway, so let's hit it right now. Ban books. It's amazing how school boards, you know, we're talking about disinformation and malinformation, and the big news really was this Nina Jankowicz dame has now been canned, at least temporarily, from the Ministry of Truth. That's been shelved because of a popular uprising. But it is amazing how certain books are being pushed, like this critical race theory that I call Jive Kempf, and transsexual nonsense. Mama has 12 vaginas on three different bodies, and or whatever you want to call it. And yet things like Rush Revere, things like the Constitution, you name it, or even Huckleberry Finn are hate speech and are to be thrown onto the Joseph Goebbels bonfire of the insanities.
I'm really tired when I see the spectrum of conservatives that are being banned from schools, banned from Amazon, banned from the social media platforms, which is the town square, and then seeing whether it's Lori Lightfoot the other day doing a posturing in Texas for some reason about I support banned books. And I was at a little event with my wife and just had politicized support banned books. And I didn't want to make a scene in front of my wife and the neighbors. Just, oh, so you support Rush Revere in our schools. Or let's be clear, you support putting irreversible damage in our schools about the whole, the permanent damage being done to young people with the whole transsexual craze. And of course not. Those books are banned from our schools. It galls me to have the left get the upper hand. We oppose censorship when they're aggressively censoring all ideas, especially in our schools.
That's exactly it. They are aggressively censoring us. But the fact is, let's back up to the basic point, banned books. These books are not banned. We haven't banned a book in the United States in, I don't know, four or five generations. The fact is that elementary school teachers should not use some books. Discussion of sex and the reading about sex in books for children is inappropriate in the schools. Yes, they should be eliminated from the curriculum. Any parent who wants to discuss sex, any parent who wants to discuss transgenderism with their children is, of course, welcome. That's called freedom. And the fact is, again, that these books are in our public libraries. They are not banned. They are controlled by the parents who are trying to guide their children's educations. That's an absolutely reasonable thing, and the phrase banned books is inaccurate.
Well, yeah, you just mentioned the magic word there, that parents want to or should or are entitled to, theoretically, guide their children's education. And that's the whole argument. That was the whole argument, the insane arguments that were appearing after the revolt, if you will, of the school board in Loudoun County, Virginia. All of a sudden, the cry was growing up where people were openly saying, parents are not qualified to have a say in how their children are educated or what their children are being educated with. That's just insane. So, I mean, when I was going to school, we did have sex education beginning in fifth grade, but it was very clinical and it was, you know, it was not the Penthouse Forum. It was not Screw Magazine. We were reading a book on biology with very sort of comical drawings, anatomical drawings, but in no way was it depicting sexual acts in an erotic fashion, let alone transsexualism or perverted sexual acts among grown adults and children, as are some of these books are. And what's really strange and what's really galling is that I think at a school board meeting, I forget, it might have even been in Virginia, a woman got up and started reading from one of these books, and she was immediately silenced and ejected from the room, which is, you talk about Orwellian. They're teaching this stuff to the children, and she's reading from the actual textbook, and they were complaining that what she was reading was inappropriate. Unbelievable.
Hey, JJ, forget that when you were in fifth grade, you were learning the biology of reproduction, and now they're teaching that the actual scientific biology is false, that boys can get pregnant. In fact, boys can be.
Absolutely. That is nuts. Who was it? There was a woman that said men can have periods and men can get pregnant. And some Democrat just said that at a congressional hearing.
Personal story. A younger brat would sometimes ask questions that were essentially, you know, what is sex? What is this? What is that? And I would keep it as clinical and as biologically accurate as possible without adding anything. And that is the appropriate way to teach children about the biology of sex. The sociology of sex, and even though sociology is a pseudoscience, but the psychology of sex and the interpersonal relationships that flow around sex are not appropriate topics for the schools. And it's there are three adults on this podcast, and all three of us are in complete agreement. It's just nuts.
Well, you know, you have what you just sparked a thought in me right there. The reason that they're teaching and making it hypersexualized to the point of pornographic is because, well, let's face it, there is this drive to normalize pedophilia in this country. And I'm not going to put too fine a point on it. That is exactly what is going on. So when you do this, when you have children, I can't believe adult parents are doing this, and that are making, dressing up their young 10-year-old son in drag, and he's a drag queen sensation. When you have drag queen story hour, this is exactly what it's coming to. So it's no surprise that the pornographic nature of these materials, which are being taught in schools as legitimate textbooks to our children, that's the purpose of it.
As I mentioned, Buck has been kind enough to provide a bunch of talking points, and the next one is fascinating to me, and that is China in the South Pacific. He writes, with an airbase in Kiribati and a naval base in the Solomon Islands, China is about to control the South Pacific from Hawaii to Australia. That's not good.
It's a terrifying time. When I was growing up, devouring all the history books about World War II and the Between the Wars era and how World War II came to be from World War I and all that, Japan in the 1930s is looking a lot like China in the 2020s right now. And we're very distracted by how many genders fifth graders should have. And that's the focus of our brightest and best right now. And meanwhile, China is building a naval base, or will be docking naval ships very close to Australia soon, in the Solomon Islands and over in the Gilbert Islands, now Kiribati. There's an air base that they've kindly built for the Kiribati government, which is closer to Hawaii than Los Angeles is to Hawaii. So 10 years from now, we may be looking at naval scene in the South Pacific and said, where'd that come from? Because of what's going on right now.
It's alarming and it's disgusting when I think about what's going on and the blood and treasure. There's that phrase again from yesterday that was spent to take those islands away from the Japanese and to liberate them. My uncle in particular, who did not come back alive from Saipan, but when you look at Guadalcanal, which is the Solomon Islands, and what we went through there, the green hell that the Marines went through, and the GIs to an extent, to liberate those from the Japanese and to drive them back towards Japan, it's the most infuriating thing that I can think of, to just all of a sudden let them have those islands. I don't understand how that's even possible. I mean, I think it goes back even 20 years when the first inklings of trouble were happening, when the Chinese were building man-made islands. I believe it was the Spratly Islands off of the Philippines. And there are also, I think it's the Paracels that are also in the South China Sea, that despite the name South China Sea, they are far enough away in international waters and in some instances really in the territorial waters of the Philippines and Vietnam to make it an actual invasion. And they've built up these military bases. And now that they're expanding way beyond their reach into the South Pacific, into our so-called sphere of influence, if you will, even though some of those possessions, except for the Marianas, which I believe are, Marianas is still American territory, but those other areas like Micronesia and Polynesia are independent states. You know, it's really, we're heading for trouble. They're looking literally to control the world. Let's not put too fine a point on it.
Okay, I'm gonna be the devil's advocate.
And I know. I know where you're going with this. I know where you're going with it. But go ahead.
Uh-oh. I wonder how strategically important these air bases are. You know, the advent of space-based missiles and hypersonic missiles that supposedly can destroy our biggest and baddest carriers and a whole litany of modern weaponry is the possession of these air bases, and that's really all they are, because they're not going to be staging invasions from them. Is the possession of these air bases that important in the 21st century?
Yeah, that's a great point. I think there's very much it's a symbolic colonial expansion that they're getting Chinese boots on the ground in the South Pacific. Whether they have a strategic importance, that's a great point. I think it's just mainly China is starting to colonize the South Pacific.
Yeah, I was going to say, I guess I didn't know where CBD was going.
But I stumped him.
I think you did stump me, but it's not difficult to do, really. Great brain here. What I was going to say is, for my devil's advocate, people can say, well, look at the United States. The United States has imposed its will all over the world. And how can it talk? You know, the United States has a presence all over the world. And how could you speak of Chinese imperialism when America has bases in Europe, America has bases in Japan and South Korea and so forth, so on and so forth? Yeah, you could make that argument. But what I would say the word right, but that's really not the right word. What possible reason could China have for establishing bases, military air bases in the South Pacific? Or, for that matter, what right does Iran have to establish bases in Venezuela? So it's a question of, you know, you could say good and evil. I mean, our intentions are not militaristic insofar as we want to control trade. We want to ensure the free flow of trade to everybody around the world. The Chinese do not want to do that. At least that's my standpoint from the whole thing.
Just one more point along those lines. All correct. We're all over the globe because we didn't want to have to clean up the globe one more time. And frankly, most of us in this conversation are tired of defending the globe. There was a famous line by somebody about why Americans were in Europe in the post-war. It was to keep Russia out, the Germans down, or something to that effect, why American troops were needed in Western Europe. The Chinese are expanding their military presence. I think we would all like to see the American foreign military presence reduced.
Absolutely. But this opens up a huge can of worms. Who is responsible for Europe's defense? Who is responsible for Australia's defense? Who is responsible for the South Pacific's defense? And yes, you can argue that historically we have taken on the brunt of that cost and that blood. But I think that currently we can't do it. We need to shift the focus on internal defense rather than external. And that's one of the reasons why I'm so disgusted by NATO. NATO is we're going all over the place here, but NATO is it's a jobs program for fat European bureaucrats. And quite frankly, we should stop paying for it. You know, if Europe wants to defend itself against Russia, then Europe should get off its ass and start building tanks and start building planes and start training their men to do things other than drink beer and criticize America.
It's exactly what's happening. I thought we were, you know, we had sort of expended the entire topic of Russia and the Ukraine. But the one, I think, salutary effect, I think, whatever you think about the Russian and Ukraine situation, is that countries like Germany and France, and especially the Eastern European nations like Poland and the Czech Republic and Slovakia and Hungary, are saying, we're gonna step up to the plate. If Russia is gonna do this, and America is either unwilling or incapable of coming to our defense or at least meeting a treaty obligation, then we better do something about that. Same goes for places like Japan and South Korea and Australia. I mean, the thought of Japan, ironically enough, making their own nuclear weapons, and quite frankly, I think they might even have them secretly. I can't confirm that, but it was my guess that Japan and possibly South Korea might have nukes or might be one step away from going nuclear. They're just keeping it on the down low. I have no problem with that. I really do not have a problem with that. It's scary and crazy as it sounds. I thought I would never say those things, but it is about time CBD, as you said, that these people stepped up to the plate and defended themselves. We shouldn't be the world's policemen. And frankly, right now, given the state of our Defense Department, which has gone into pregnancy flight suits and transsexuals in the front lines wearing heels, I don't think we have the capability even to defend the world, let alone our own territory, which is, you know, I think that we are in a very dangerous spot in that regard.
Yeah, one more thing, the way the conversation is morphed into talking about NATO. My post tomorrow, the morning of Friday the 20th, tomorrow, is actually about NATO and Finland, asking for NATO membership. And the prime minister of Finland, her name is Sanna Marin. A day or two after Trump was elected, she went on Twitter to have a little temper tantrum, saying that how racism and immigration gave us white racism and immigration gave us Trump. But now she's willing to let American boys, probably the same deplorables that she's calling racist, come defend Finland and die on her soil to protect her people. Why? We've got to stop this. We need to disincentivize this anti-Americanism. And if someone is so publicly hateful and spiteful and going to slander and smear us, and she wants us to come defend Finland now. I mean, Finns are historically great people and fought like hell against the Russians in World War II. But if they're going to elect a prime minister who's going to call us all a bunch of racists, they don't deserve our defense.
Perfect. That's exactly it. And Rich Smaller, you can that just described every little pissant country in Europe. Not quite so obvious, although that's not true. Occasionally we get that the foaming at the mouth anti-Americanism.
The anti-Americanism, but, by the way, I think comes mostly from the Western nations whom we liberated.
Yeah,
oddly enough, it's the Eastern European nations like Poland, Hungary, the Czech Republic, and Slovakia, and all the others that were under the Iron Curtain and under the jackboot of Stalin, who know exactly what goes on, that appreciate freedom after the last 30 years and appreciate Ronald Reagan and what America did in defeating the Soviet Union in the Cold War and essentially liberating their nations after, 75 years essentially of having Roosevelt and Harry Hopkins and all the people behind the scenes at the State Department stabbing Eastern Europe in the back and giving them to the Soviet Union when we guaranteed that they would have free elections. But that's it. They appreciate what we did for them. Unfortunately, Western Europe is still under this yoke of this stereotypical hatred of ugly Americans and so on and so forth, and the typical left-wing bullshit that comes, pardon my French, that actually came from Russia. All the anti-Americanism really is fomented by former KGB agents over the years, and that's where it came from. Also, the inherent leftism and lazy socialism of Europeans themselves, and there's the irony right there as well.
Well, I wonder if the perception of Europe is as tainted for us as the perception of America is tainted for Europe. They see us through the lens of the New York Times and the Washington Post and AP and you know the usual left of center rags that they read. How much information are they getting from the heartland? How much of the flyover states do they even understand? And I think the answer is not very much. The question is that the same thing in Europe? Probably less so, but I can't imagine that the Normans feel the same way about the United States as the Parisians do.
I was going to say exactly that. If you go visit the American cemetery, either in Holland or in Normandy, the people there, even as that generation that experienced, that were liberated by Operation Overlord and the Americans and the British and Canadians, even the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren of their that are now living there as adults and their forebears who have now passed on, they still appreciate and love Americans and have a great respect for America for what they did and for the price that we paid to liberate those towns. Paris, of course, not so much, but there you have it. All right, let's take a little break. Cut Jib Newsletter Speaks, the podcast. Back with CBD and Buck Throckmorton in just a second. And we're back at the Cut Jib Newsletter Speaks podcast. Buck, one of your topics today is, the green madness and what's going on here with the deindustrialization, the move away from oil, and what's going on. There's a huge story that's going on that's actually has very little coverage, if zero coverage, because it's kind of embarrassing for all the greenies, is that Sri Lanka, the country of Sri Lanka, formerly known as Ceylon, off the coast of India, is in dire straits and is now mandating organic farming over the years. And now suddenly, a couple of years later, they're on the brink of starvation.
I wrote about that a week or so ago. And then since then, it's gone even further downhill in Sri Lanka. And as Ace had a post a couple of days ago, the starving people get really upset about starving, and they're taking it out of politicians. It's a scary thing that the whole green energy, I call it the sustainable organic church of the carbon apocalypse. When my wife and I escaped from Austin, we actually felt like when we just moved into a smaller southern U.S. town that's very religious, but we got a break from religion because the crushing orthodoxy of the sustainable organic church of the carbon apocalypse and blue insane. And the trouble is, it's fine if that's the whole organic thing and turning recycling into some kind of sacrament. And if you want to throw some solar panels on your roof, great. Knock yourself out. But this boutique lifestyle of the affluent that's really religious is deadly when imposed on the masses. So, of course, what Sri Lanka did is, I guess someone who's enchanted by the women of Whole Foods decided that he was going to impose organic farming on the entire country of Sri Lanka. And just predictably, no fertilizer, crop yields went down, people were starving. Rather than exporting certain crops like tea, they had to start importing basic food substance. They didn't have the cash because they were no longer exporting their export crops. And then the currency collapsed, and now it's in turmoil. That is organic farming. And by the way, that's also green energy. There are no magic unicorns. There's not enough land to do solar panels and wind. And you may have seen this in what I write, that I am passionate about how I fear the greens and the whole the green organic, all that, probably more than anything else, because that is going to destroy our civilization. And Sri Lanka was just a test and showed it.
Absolutely. The idea of organic farming is adorable. It's cute. Everybody feels so good about it. But the problem is that you can't feed the world organically. One of the glories of Western civilization has been the incredible efficiency, torn out of incredible, incredible difficulties over the last couple of thousand years of our agriculture. You know, you drive up to Western Massachusetts or probably anywhere in the United States to the touchy-feely areas, and you see these adorable organic farms, and you can pull over and you can buy beautiful, lovely produce, and you can see the solar panels up on the buildings, and it just feels so nice. But they're not feeding America. You drive out to the wheat belt or the corn belt or the soybean belts in America, and you see tens of thousands of acres of perfectly run farms. These are farms that are incredibly efficient. They know down to the cubic foot of water how much they need. They know to the pound of fertilizer how much they're going to use. They know how deep they need to plow. They know where to irrigate at what time. They're using satellite imagery to maximize yield. They're using all of the technology available to the world to feed us, and they're doing a great job of it. And for these organic lunatics, these green fascists, to push organic, as Buck has said, or the organic religion on us is a terrible, terrible insult to 2,000 or 3,000 years of Western culture. A man named Norman Borlaug, who has done more than any man on earth, any man in history, to feed us, would be turning over into his grave right now.
Well, you know, it goes back to the Environmental Protection Agency, and the seeds of that, so to speak, is the damnable, and I say that in the strongest possible terms, the damnable Rachel Carson and William Ruckelshaus, when they decided that DDT was killing, you know, was killing the birds and all this kind of stuff, and they banned DDT. And when they banned DDT, what happened? Several hundred million Africans and Asians and third world people died of insect-borne diseases needlessly, because DDT, when used properly, and generally it is used properly, is just as safe as any other chemical out there. But it was basically blood libeled as some kind of devil's poison, and that was that. And so, just like we're doing with the whole COVID nonsense, we have people who are literally have committed a crime against humanity, resulting in the deaths of tens of millions of people, hundreds of millions of people. Ironically, the very same black and brown people that they claim that we, the white colonialists, are oppressing, when meanwhile their actions have led to their deaths, and it's frankly completely unnecessary and it's disgusting. And now they're trying to ban oil. And as I've said many, many times before, oil is not just gasoline. Oil is fertilizer. Oil is medicines. Oil are all the chemicals, everything that you eat, sleep on, wear, come into contact with, buy, or whatever in your life is either made from or has some component that is a petrochemical. And a huge chunk of that are fertilizers and pesticides. And when you do away with that, watch the crop yields go to shit. And beyond just transporting fresh crops and produce in refrigerated trucks and trains, which has brought all the wonders, the bounty of America and the world, to the world, I should say, that's going to disappear, and we are going to starve, just like Sri Lanka.
Yeah, related to that, it's you talk about energy, the green energy, and the organic thing go hand in hand. I don't wish what could happen to Europe on Europe, but what I fear about this whole green energy push we may have an interesting test drive coming up in Europe as soon as this next winter. They went, Germany idiotically decided to go all green. You could do a whole podcast on what Angela Merkel and Merkel to destroy her country. But part of it is the green energy thing. And by closing their nuclear plants, allegedly getting off petroleum, just really importing products from Russia and trying to go green. And so much of the rest of Europe followed that now with Western Europe trying not to import gas and petroleum products from Russia, or maybe Russia cuts them off or who knows what happens, but they could have a cold, dark winter. And again, all that utopian stuff about green energy and windmills and such, that when people are starving in Europe, my God, that continent, we don't need another world war, but I'd rather have a test drive of green energy policies where they ultimately lead to in Europe than in my country.
Well, oh, see, this is where Buck and I have to agree to disagree. I want them to feel the pain. I'm serious. Buck's a nicer person than I am. I want them to feel the pain. Germany has been pissing in our faces probably since the 1970s. France, in their haughty arrogance, has been pissing in our faces since De Gaulle in the 60s. And then, to a lesser extent, all the other pissant little countries in Western Europe. You know something? I want them to freeze. That will make me smile, because these decisions that they have made are made with the assumption that the United States is going to bail them out, and we should not bail them out. And at this point, we can't.
Couple of interesting observations here to your rant, CPD, and I agree with it. Number one, my mother, as some of you or many of you may know, survived a nice little stay in a nice holiday camp under the auspices of the SS. And so when she got out, she had no love lost for Western Europe, and she said, for all she concerned, she wanted the Russian army to roll all the way to the English Channel. She really for what they did to the Jews, but that's another story, and it's understandable. But on that note, speaking of the French, in this regard, France called Israel, or someone in France was heard on a microphone referring to Israel as that shitty little country. Well, as it turns out, now that Russia is no longer going to be supplying oil and natural gas to Europe, Israel finds itself sitting on one of the hugest natural gas and petroleum fields off its coast in the Mediterranean, and along with Greece and Cyprus, is looking to build a pipeline to go to Europe. And so now all of a sudden it would be delicious irony indeed that these same countries that are now so hot and horny for the boycott, divest, and sanctions regime to destroy the state of Israel may actually find themselves begging the state of Israel for their oil and natural gas. Of course, the Israelis being who they are, and it will probably oblige them. But I would say no, go. If I were an Israeli, I'd say no, go screw yourself. Or I would make the conditions so interesting, shall we say, that it would stick in their craws. But that is the irony. And the other irony of Germany going green and killing itself is, in a positive way, the Russia-Ukraine situation, here we are back again, is that it has exposed the folly of, number one, of not having any kind of defense, but also going green. When you do this and it fails and you need gas, guess what? You're going to shit can all of these idiotic policies as quickly as you can, if it's even possible, and build and fire up every nuclear plant and every oil plant that you possibly can. So in a way, the Russia-Ukraine situation has exposed all this for the insane folly that it is. Will the environmentalists accept that? Of course they won't, but that's another story.
Well, that's a perfect segue into Buck's next point about electric vehicles.
Let us take a break. We will get back to Buck's point of electric vehicles in just a second on the Cut Chip Newsletter Speaks podcast. And we're back once again, CBD and Buck Throckmorton. Buck, the next subject, as we talk about the disaster that's of the green church of the poison mind. I forget how you put it. It was genius. But now we all of a sudden have this push for electric vehicles going on, and that's crazy.
The EV push is absolutely tied to the hip of the whole green energy movement, and it's an absolute fantasy that there's enough electricity to be generated, much less stored, much less transmitted, in a green fashion to even sustain what we have right now, much less convert the entire fleet of vehicles from gas to electric. And it's, I know a few EV evangelists, they love their electric vehicle. How, you know, I can even get from Nashville to Daytona Beach, so big deal. I stop, you know, refuel, have a meal. That the logistics of every car on the highway refueling is not possible. And I guess since we're living in a world where we say that men can have babies, saying things that are not true is what politicians have to do. But politicians and even CEOs of auto companies are saying we can switch to 100% electric. It's absolutely not possible from a science and technology perspective and just how people use their vehicles. And I used to always think that CEOs and the C-suite people, they were just talking along to idiotic political stuff to humor the politicians. But I genuinely believe, I listened to Mary Barra, the CEO of GM. Mm-hmm. She believes this stuff. And I'm watching Ford is building a new plant out in Memphis. Volkswagen allegedly is building this whole new plant in Tennessee. It's going to be all electric. There's not the raw materials. There's not the demand. And is this going to just be a crash and burn? I'm wondering where this is going to go. But it's these people, I guess, believe this.
Well, that's just it. They do believe it. And as we've said before with the whole woke corporation nonsense, when I see someone of our people of our age, when I see logos of U.S. Steel, of Ford, of you name it, Exxon, you name the corporation, you know, I think of corporate America. I think of Henry Ford, well, anti-Semite, but that's another story. You know, I think of these titans of industry, George Westinghouse, you name it. But no, they're populated by these, you know, purple-haired, bearded knuckleheads from the Ivy League who believe Buck, you're absolutely right. They are true believers. They swallow this crap hook, line, and sinker, and to the detriment of stockholders. Look what Disney did. Disney is doing this, and it's one of Disney's progeny. They don't give a damn about what it is. They are going to push the transsexual nonsense no matter what. Same thing with this, the green energy, even though it doesn't exist. And on another point, the energy capacity, what is a battery? A battery is beyond just the electricity that goes into it. You need lithium. And what is lithium? Lithium is a metal that I think most of the stock is where? I believe it's in China. Oh, yes, that nice country that is our wonderful friend. And
well, let's return to a previous topic. There's a lot of it in Australia. And look what China is doing. They're expanding to the South Pacific. Maybe their goal is Australia to corner the world lithium market.
It's funny how all those topics keep overlapping. You know, when people sometimes ask me, what are you most passionate about other than upright bases? You know, what are you most passionate about?
You are the upright baseman.
He is the upright baseman. Yeah.
You are the Charlie Mingus of our – I think he was a base guy.
Yeah, I always talk about the green energy, organic thing. But as you just point out, it all goes back into there's the globalism. There's all the principal free traders who exported all our jobs. There's the destroying the American military through PC stuff. All those things interact. And yeah, how quickly do we go from talking about the whole EV folly to the whole global problems we're having?
To answer your question, I think that at least part of the drive in the C-suites for electric vehicles and for the EV revolution is rent seeking. I think that several of these car companies have made the calculation that government, which is a very, very large buyer of vehicles, is going to be a very, very large buyer of electric vehicles. And they want to get on board that very lucrative portion of the market. Although the U.S. Postal Service rejected the idea of electric vehicles because it simply will not work for what they need. But, you know, getting back to the specifics of electric vehicles, they are very, very nice for a small number of uses. Somebody who has a 20-mile commute every day. Perfect. You drive to work, you drive back, you plug in overnight. That's fantastic. But do you take that car on vacation? No, of course not. That's ridiculous. And plus, there's a huge, huge premium paid for electric vehicles. I just bought a car last month, and I actually looked at the electric version of it's an SUV, a large SUV, and it would have been about between $15,000 and $20,000 more. And I mean, I did back of the envelope calculation, and of course, it's a ridiculous amount of money to spend for, you know, the $3,000 or $4,000 worth of fuel that I would save. And until that changes, and it will not change because physics will not change, but until that changes, as Buck said, these are not mass market products. These are going to be niche pot products for the foreseeable future until physics changes.
You know, you talked about the government and the United States Postal Service not buying electric vehicles. I seem to recall, maybe 20 years ago when the Segway was the big thing and nobody bought a Segway. you know, and then they said, well, the U.S. Postal Service will buy them for their postal employees, and that didn't pan out. So the Segway has gone the way of the dodo, as will, well, I who knows what the electric vehicle thing will do. But, you know, I look at Elon Musk, and, you know, he's got some great accomplishments. This is not even about Twitter, per se. But one of the things he promised was he promised an electric 18-wheeler. And, I, you know, if you can't have a car that can take a family of four, you know, as big as a Volt without having a to recharge every 200 miles, I mean, you know, an 18-wheeler. And now I hear they're talking about, you know, jumbo jets that are electric powered. It ain't happening. You know, I mean, concrete canoes, it may happen before we have a solar powered 747. So this is just pie in the sky. Will it happen? Could it happen? Sure, it could. But it's not up to the government. It's not up to me, the taxpayer. And it's not up to a 5-year plan forced on us by Stalinists to go green to have this develop. If somebody wants to build a better mousetrap in the privacy of their own garage, let them do it. Let them finally come up with the product where CBD can do his back of the envelope calculation that, yeah, the cost is going to save me money over time over gasoline, or it's definitely going to be able to take 15 tons of iceberg lettuce from California to Maine in one day and not need a charge. When that happens, when it's done privately, yeah, the gasoline powered vehicles ultimately will go out of business and go the way of the horse and buggy. But the way things are going now, especially in Sri Lanka, we're going to need horses and buggies. And I would say go long on buggy whips. It's coming back, baby.
You know, actually, that's a great point, JJ. That's I forgot to get to earlier. Again, things that get in my crawl, the whole EV thing, it's because it's being jammed down our throats by government. You have, I think, several entire states, the big states, New York and California, are mandating the abolition of sale of internal combustion engines, I think, within 7, 8, 9, 10 years. And so I'm already sick of California determining what my vehicle needs to be like. And if we have enough states do this nonsense, then the competitive market for internal combustion cars goes away. That is the engine of freedom. And I guess part of my gripe with electric vehicles is how it's being embraced and mandated by people who dislike my freedom.
If you have to mandate something, you know, it ain't good. That's just my, you know, that's sort of a prima facie observation. If you're forcing me to do something, how good could it possibly be? You know, I mean, yes, your mother told you this is for your own good, but my mother, God bless her, is long gone. I do not want Joe Biden to be my mother, and he is not my mother, nor is Nina Jankowicz, nor is Nancy Pelosi, nor is anybody else. I am my own mother, and that's the end of it. And this is what it's all about. But no, they know better than you. They know better than you how to run your life. And in essence, there's the nub of a, you know, a government, top-down government-controlled bureaucracy. These elite people, or who think they're elite, they call themselves the best and the brightest, and they're going to plan your future whether you like it or not. And what's been the result? Well, look at every disaster America has faced since the end of World War II, whether it's foreign policy, whether it's domestic policy, you name it, it's all led to death and destruction and misery. And of course, nobody is to blame, but we haven't tried it. It hasn't been tried by the right people yet. That's the problem. Or you plebes in flyover country are ungrateful and you're sabotaging us. So,
well, that's a nice segue into one of Buck's many topics. Thank you so much, Buck, by the way. Starveflation, which I think is a very interesting term to describe it. Are we looking at food shortages to accompany crippling inflation? Well, you know, if we use electric 18-wheelers, yes, we are going to have food shortages.
That was a commenter by the name of Shane S.
Yes.
I came up with that term, and I actually Googled it. I couldn't find it anywhere, so I believe that's a Shane S. original.
That's fantastic.
Stagflation in starflation. Because remember in the glory years of the Carter administration, when I was just a little kid in grade school, there was stagflation. I didn't really fully understand how bad it was till later. And that, I guess that was a recession with high unemployment and high inflation. And now we're adding in empty shelves with high inflation. And again, I just am very anxious. We've seen what happens when people are hungry and where there's food shortages. It's scary. And people can't afford food. It is bad enough when there is no food on the shelves. Mercy.
When you can't afford the food that's not on the shelves, that's there you go. And it reminded me, I wanted to give Shane S. a cardboard membership to Ace of Spades, but I think right now, because of starflation, he has to have the tree bark membership.
Yeah.
So we'll upgrade it.
No, that's interesting. And you know, it goes back to what we were talking about, the green organic religion, as opposed to the agricultural revolution that 3,000 years of Western culture produced. We have the technology to feed everyone. We have the technology to move food efficiently. We have the technology to grow safe food, and it is only as a result of government policy that has impeded that ease in a modern world. And it, you know, it's disgusting that in 21st century America, that mothers need to worry about where they're going to get formula for their children, and working class people need to worry about how much it's going to cost to feed their kids. And that's the thing. The fix is so, so simple. And Donald Trump, for all of his problems as a politician, understood this perfectly. And you know what that is? Just leave us alone. It's as simple as that. Let the engine of commerce fire away. It is a simple, simple fix. Leave it alone.
What was that French word we all learned? Laissez-faire? The laissez-faire economics?
Yeah.
The invisible hand? All of these things. You know, I always try to just boil it down and boil things down to people who, you know, who are, let's say, liberals, who are angry at certain things. And I always try to boil it down and reduce it to the simplest argument, which is, at the end of the day, it's supply and demand. And that's all it is. And that's what drives economies. When somebody needs something and you have something to offer, you offer a fair price so that you can feed your family and he or she can get the thing or service or good that you are providing. When the government steps in to regulate that for whatever reason it wants to do it, it just Fs the whole thing to hell. And I mean, we talk about the shortages of baby formula. That's got nothing to do with crops. That's got everything to do with the FDA declaring that formula that is from Europe is not fit for American babies' consumption. And so when the supply chain foul-ups happen, and or whatever is going on with the one plant, and I can't believe we only have one manufacturer that makes baby formula in this country, for whatever reason that is, who knows what, then, you know, you're looking at a complete disaster that could have been totally avoided and was totally unnecessary. But because the government decided that they're going to regulate this thing, that is the root cause of that problem. And, you know, and then, of course, we have the solution to it. So, yes, they compound the problem with more problems.
Hey,
unbelievable.
Real quick,
yeah.
Along those lines, that the FDA just so cavalierly shutting down a plant based on two deaths, which turned out weren't related, but just to be safe, they shut down the plant. And then, of course, we can't import formula because of regulations. And so the shelves are empty, but baby formula, that goes on thousands and thousands and thousands of times across this country with smaller and mid-sized businesses dealing with regulators, OSHA, and local agencies that authorize them to do business. And it's one thing, if anything good comes with this baby shortage thing, I hope people realize how cavalier government regulators and just shutting down a business, one person makes one decision to do that. And that happens thousands of times, tens of thousands times a year across this country to important businesses.
You know what they should have shut down and they didn't shut down? The pharmaceutical companies.
Yeah.
For this cockamamie COVID vaccine. This vaccine has killed thousands and thousands of people, and they refuse to shut it down. And anybody who is saying this, who is quoting the Vaccineverse event reporting system, is perpetuating disinformation or misinformation. And we talked about this yesterday. There was a vaccine that was developed for swine flu. When the swine flu vaccine, and I was wrong, I said 40 people, 40. When 14 people died during the trials, they shut it down. But COVID, all these vaccines, we have people getting heart murmurs, we have people getting COPD, we have people dying in the thousands. But no, you must be vaccinated, you must be boosted, and you must do this every year, twice a year, for however many years, and ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine will not be given to you, and if you dare prescribe it, we'll revoke your medical license. So you talk about, you know, the FDA regulating, it's crazy. They regulate the shit out of baby formula, so it's unavailable. But vaccines that kill tens of thousands of people, no, you have to have that. This is how revolutions, I'm not going to say how revolutions start, but how revolutions should start. And I'm getting very close to a very dangerous point here, and I better shut up.
You know, the sad thing is that, and this speaks to the, right back to the organic religion that Buck has discussed, and that is the irrationality of it. Look at the science, look at the data, look at the engineering, and make your decisions based on those things. If the COVID-19 vaccine were as good as they say, then why did they have to mandate it? It's the same thing as electric vehicles. If they're as good as you say they are, then what's the problem? I'm going to buy one.
Absolutely. The mandating the vaccine is so offensive and off to a different place. But with the vaccines, but the whole COVID thing, that we've had two friends die, one of COVID, one who I believe died because of the vaccine. Well, of course, we lost Oregon Muse to it, but a young man, young 50s, who was not vaccinated, died of COVID. A good friend of my wife, 53, fit, healthy woman, 53, died of a heart attack. I've never known of a healthy woman under age 60 to die of a heart attack. But what makes me so upset is, beyond the vaccine, China did this to us. Both of those people are dead now because of China. I believe that man would be alive had he taken the vaccine, and I believe the woman would be alive had she not taken the vaccine. But had China not imposed this, infected the world with this disease, both of them would be alive, and we're still tripping over ourselves trying to be polite to China. It's so offensive.
And the fact that they, again, you know, and we'll never know. We can place Monday morning quarterbacks with this thing. And again, it's biology, it's biochemistry, it's things that it's beyond my skill sets here. But the fact that they refuse to release all these therapeutics, which could have helped, which have given, which your friends and relatives who tragically died, one from the vaccine and one from the virus itself, if these therapeutics were available immediately, if they were put on a regimen immediately, it might have mitigated it to the point where number one, your friend who died from the vaccine would not have needed the vaccine, and your friend who died of COVID might have survived. The infection might not have been so bad that it would have killed them. But we'll never know, because those things which have been used for decades all over the world to combat viruses as antivirals were forbidden here because Anthony Fauci and the powers that be demanded that you submit and get this jungle juice in your veins. To some people, it helped, and to many people, it didn't. And but we'll never know. We'll never know. But the root cause of this thing, yes, that we're overlooking, is what China did, and then whether it was a crisis of convenience or this was pre-planned in advance, how the Democrats and the globalists used that as the pretext to basically shut us down, screw up whatever election laws that were on the books, and paved the way for the theft of the 2020. I guess I better cut this out because Buck is uncomfortable. So we'll just edit that.
No,
out. Sorry.
I'm fine.
You are fine with that. I can say that. Well, yeah. In my opinion only, but you know, I'll. Yeah, I know you're. I forgot that you're sensitive about that. So maybe I shouldn't say that.
But, oh no.
What is? And I've spoken about this many, many times in the past. And what is frustrating is that they involve themselves, the government involve themselves in things that they should not be involved. The organic religion, electric vehicles, the relationship between physicians and their patients, the scientific analysis, the data analysis of a vaccine. These should be done by rational people basing their decisions on science. And the fact that it has not done that, that it has not happened that way, makes me sad. Anyway,
the party of science, but they're not the party of science. Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, let's take a break and we will come back and wrap it up.
And we're back for our final segment with CBD, J.J. Sefton here, and our guest, our co-blogger, Buck Throckmorton. And I believe the topic was 21st century feudalism?
Yeah, I wrote about this recently. When I was as happy as anybody when Elon Musk announced he was buying Twitter, I find Twitter is a great way to, I follow conservative thought leaders and some really bad lefties on Twitter to see what's going on in the world. And it's interesting, but obviously they throttle. I mean, John Hayward, has anyone do better rants on Twitter than John Hayward? I have to seek him out. I'm thrilled.
We had John Hayward as a guest a couple episodes back.
Yeah, exactly. And there's nothing I can do to make him come into my feed. I have to go look for him because Twitter is so evil how it tries to suppress. But so that said.
Oh, that's interesting.
Elon Musk was buying Twitter, that he's advocating for free speech. And we're all euphoric. Hooray. Elon Musk to our rescue. how did we get to the point in this representative democracy that we need an oligarch to be our to fight for us, to defend us, to be our savior, and realize, oh my God, yeah, Elon Musk is going to fight for us against the evil Bill Gates and the all the other evil oligarchs like Zuckerberg and all. Yay, I guess. I'm glad to have him on my team and fighting for me. But where are we then if that's what we've reverted to, that we have to rally around our rich guy who will protect us rather than having the system of government set up in the you know what the 1770s and 1780s?
That's a great point. And, you know, you go back to the beginning of our country or the 10 years before the beginning of our country, and you see thought leaders who simply had a printing press and a couple of hundred pamphlets they would distribute. And that simply cannot happen today because of the first of all, the immense costs involved in becoming any kind of a significant voice on the internet, but also as Buck is pointing out, the government pushing back against bad thoughts, essentially.
Well, that's what, speaking of John Hayward, Doc Zero, he was mentioning this when he was a guest on the podcast, how in the beginnings of the internet, how wonderful it was that you had all these blogs, and it was an example of the free market of ideas, and everybody was out there with a blog, everyone was doing their thing, and how little by little, you know, whatever, if you, the good ones, the cream always rose to the top, and we gravitated towards that. For us, it was Ace of Spades, and you know, the beginnings of Breitbart, and when it was legitimately good in the beginning, Hot Air, and that's become now, you know, Warm Flatus, unfortunately. But that's what happened. And then the government freaked out over this, and they said, as did media did, and they openly dropped any of their pretenses of being impartial, which that was a complete mask and a total farce. And they were openly rooting for the left, as we saw with Dan Rather and Bush with the Texas Air National Guard thing, to name just one episode. But that is it. I mean, we've now gotten to the point where these billionaires are the ones that are vying for, you know, we're going to be on this landlord's land. We're going to be the serfs over here. Elon Musk may be great, and Elon Musk is telling us he's going to vote Republican for the first time in his life. But at the same token, yeah, he is a billionaire, and I'm glad he's doing what he's doing, and he's saying all the right things. But, you know, we're sort of, you know, the movie Rollerball is supposed to be a movie, not a plan for, you know, we are all going to now rise to sing the corporate anthem. This is not the way things are supposed to be. Hopefully Musk will herald an era where the freedom will come back, but for sure the government's going to push back. We talked about this, Ministry of Truth with Nina Jankowicz, the Mary Poppins singing Gruppenführer who channels Leni Riefenstahl and Joseph Goebbels and gleefully wanting to silence us. So, and then I can't believe the FCC has not stepped in with Mignon Clyburn or whoever the heck it is, going to literally pull the plug on the internet. I expect that that's going to happen. Whether it's food riots or the midterms or whatever calamity is going to befall us in the next 6 months, the government will step in, and we, because of the national emergency, is going to have to control communication. I see it happening.
Well, that's a cheery thought. Thank you so much for that.
You know, I'm here to cheer you up and here to shuttle you into, you know, your Jonathan E. Rollerball rink of whatever.
You know, the idea of 21st century feudalism is interesting because perhaps we will finally get the answer, what is better, longbow or crossbow. So,
gentlemen, I think we have exhausted our topics, and great topics that they are. Buck, is there any passing thoughts, any final thoughts or birds you want to flip at any particular targets?
No. I enjoy so much your podcast, and it's privileged on, and really enjoy it when you bring in people outside of the cop circle too, like I say, John Hayward and all, and hope you can continue to expand on that. It's a real treat to hear the two of y'all with people outside of our little circle.
Well, we're expanding day by day, I hope. Maybe like Jerry Nadler, I'm not sure.
You know, actually, Buck, Seth and I have talked briefly about bringing on a leftist, which I think would be entertaining and certainly interesting, and we can't find one. And which is sad because they're so doctrinaire for the most part. Yeah.
I would love to get someone like, as we talked about, like Glenn Greenwald or Naomi Wolf or Matt Taibbi, because yeah, they're leftists and they're just, you know, in their beliefs, but at least they believe in free speech and they believe that I have a right to an opinion to disagree with them. And from there, we can talk about, whatever we want to talk about. But everybody else, as we were discussing, it is a religion. It's not only a religion, it's absolute fundamentalism. It's cult-like. So there can be no. This is why they want to silence us. You can't just have your opinions, because they can't fight our opinions on a level playing field. So they have to silence us. Not only that, because it goes against it's like Islam. Anything that is against it is an apostate and must be put down. So we ain't ever going to get any leftists on this show.
Probably not.
Greenwalder or guys like that, there's such a reshuffling of right, left, Democrat, Republican going on right now that, I mean, 20 years ago that I think I'd be bashing corporations, and you're seeing those on things that Mexican Americans in South Texas, who I know love, spent so much time with, exasperated their loyalty to the Democrats, that they were finally going to dump the Democrats. There's a big reshuffling going on, so I don't even know where Greenwald and those people fit in the spectrum anymore.
Well, it's like, you know,
they fit in the most important niche in that spectrum, and that is freedom. They believe in it. And, you know, Greenwald and Naomi Wolf, and I mean, in particular, Naomi Wolf, their politics are far, far, far to the left of mine. And I would disagree about most things. But the fact that they believe that I have the absolute right to disagree with them is the reason why they are important.
Well, who would have thought that, you know, 20 years ago, or 20 years since then, I should say, Cindy Sheehan is now the voice of reason. Everybody who was saying no blood for oil, you know, wants Putin's head on a pike and wants to send American troops into Ukraine to go toe-to-toe with the Russians. Yeah. So for Cindy Sheehan, she was 20 years too early. She, whatever. You know, but I would just love to have somebody on here to say, CBD, you ignorant slut. You know, that would be the old, or JJ, you ignorant schmuck, get off the air. You creep. Yeah. Anyway, that's it for the Cut Jib what is our name? Cut Jib Newsletter Speaks podcast. JJ Sefton, CBD, and the great Buck Throckmorton. We will see you again real soon, folks. Thanks again.
Thanks for listening, folks.